That was an amazing fade out. Incredible. Thanks, Jesse.
Sure.
Okay, I'm gonna read another little. I got this book at an estate sale. And I love this. It's just priceless.
When they were referring to the bitch.
Yeah.
Were they referring to a racing dog?
A pig.
A pig. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I thought that was appropriate for Jackson.
I don't know.
Exactly. A pig. It was a pig. I should have had a guess this animal part of this. Oops. Okay, so this is taken from a section called Hysteria of Sexually Unsatisfied Women. This is 1950. So there's all these cases. There's like seven cases of different examples of hysterical and unsatisfied women. This is case number six. A bachelor of about 55 was frequently visited by the daughter of a friend from the country, a woman of about 30. One Sunday, when the girl came to his flat, the man opened the door himself and suddenly kissed her on the lips. As she did not resist, he laid her on the bed and indulged in all sorts of manipulations, which she permitted. After this, the girl declared that the man must marry her, as he had robbed her of her innocence. The man tried to calm her, and explaining that she had not lost her innocence at all, he refused to marry her. The girl then had a severe attack of hysteria. She ran to her own and the man's relations, described everywhere in vehement and graphic language what had happened, wrote the man alternately ardent love letters and letters of abuse, and finally became so excitable that she had to be sent to an institution. The end. They're like amazing little short stories. They're so great. Okay, Eric Anderson. Many people have told me they don't understand the work of Eric Anderson. Because of his thick Michigan accent. Sometimes, I tell them, understanding is not important. Just listen to the sound of the words he's saying and nod your head approvingly, as you would do for any other nonsensical maniac you might meet in Midwest America. Here then is Eric the schoolboy maniac, Anderson.
That's great. I don't know what to make of the fact, though, that your segue into that was a story about a sexually unsatisfied woman. I'll just leave that alone.
Okay.
So, I'm going to read... Yes, okay, I'm going to read. There were other things that I wanted to say, though, and now I'm forgetting what they were. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Will. Hi. Will.
Hi, nice to meet you. Ethiopian food.
It was pretty good, actually. Yeah. It had been a long time since I'd had any Ethiopian, but it was very good. So I'm going to read some... just a few newish poems that I'm going to read the last section of my book, The Poetics of Trespass, which I'll talk about in a second after I read these new couple of poems. Or relatively new. I have a 2.5-year-old, so I don't really write very much these days. Mostly I just chase the toddler around. Here at the edge of the fog, but you see, it isn't a fog. Rather, the product of a smoke machine, its equivalent in words. I also believe in a well-made tree, but I couldn't say how to make one. Equal parts, context, and time. In the future, there will be no more fog, or else there will be nothing but fog, or future, Yes, there will be nothing but future. I don't understand the assassin. I understand the reporter, whose world ends at his mistakes. This building, for instance, how he confuses it for the walls along its perimeter. But it isn't the hives, precisely, that keep the bees from escaping. In the morning, nothing is ever quite where I leave it. I've never read any of these poems aloud before, so it's kind of a trip. There are only swallows, and underneath them, the shadows of swallows. Imagine a swallow that could carry the sky on its back. You've just imagined a bluebird. Imagine a man who could carry the earth on his shoulders. In the middle of the night, I dreamed of lines I've now forgotten, or maybe I dreamed of forgetting them. Frogs don't dream, and yet I can only remember, as though in a dream, the frog state, that is, genetically, history. What a cage to have crawled out of. Imagine the first frog, the first dream, the first dreamer. A dream of frogs, no doubt, of water. So I'll read this final section from the book. So this book, the conceit of it, or the structure, was that I took these eight walks in the series in the shapes of these eight letters. The word that I spelled out in the walks was pastoral. So I took these eight walks, then I wrote essays about the walks, kind of, and then I included this other essay at the very end of it, at the end of the book, called The Neighbor, which we were just talking about in the car ride up from Portland. It doesn't really, it sort of sits alongside the book. It doesn't, it kind of comments on the book without being a part of it in a weird way. Which I like, for some reason. So, and this I don't think I've ever read aloud either, so I don't know. This is a night of firsts. Who knows what will happen when I leave here tonight. The Neighbor, Hong Kong, 1966, 1967. The piece is called The Neighbor, and there are all of these little subtitles. So the first subtitle is called Hong Kong, 1966, 1967. In April of 1966, riots erupted in Hong Kong. People flooded the streets of neighboring Kowloon, which lies on the opposite side of Victoria Harbor, in response to the British colonial government's proposed rate hike for the ferry between the two cities. The Star Ferry Company, founded in 1898 and still in operation today, managed to increase its rates despite mass protests and millions of dollars in damage by 25%. In September of that year, Charles de Gaulle, who had overseen the final failures of French colonialism in Algeria and Vietnam, visited Cambodia, another former French colony. While there, he gave a speech exhorting the United States to end its growing involvement in Vietnam, where in just 3 years there would be over 500,000 American soldiers fighting what was, by most accounts, an unwinnable war. A little over a year later, Hong Kong was in chaos again as people took to the streets once more. Though these later riots began as a labor strike, they soon devolved into anarchy, with protesters planting bombs around the city and the police arresting nearly 5,000 people. Toten Alberg, 1967. At the same time that unrest was sweeping through Southeast Asia, Martin Heidegger, who had first been banned from teaching after World War II, taught his final course. Man is the neighbor of being, he had written years earlier, meaning, in part, that we live in proximity to our own existence. Distance inheres in our being. We are ourselves, but at a remove, on just the other side of some invisible fence where being performs its wonders. But being a neighbor is tricky, both in Heidegger and in the world, and concealed in the neighbor is the nigh boar, nigh having meant near as long as anyone can remember, and boar coming from bower, a word we think of as having to do with place, but which originally involved farmers, peasants, or clowns. One sense of the Dutch root boer includes someone who cheats at cards, and the shortened word boer is itself an East Anglian greeting. So we become buffoons to being. We clown around in proximity to ourselves. In our natural state, our behavior is, if not fundamentally at odds with our existence, then peripheral to it, ultimately unknowable by it. Hong Kong, 1962. In the beginning of In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai's 2001 film, two people, a Mr. Chow and a woman who, when asked for her name, responds that her husband's name is Chan, move into rented rooms in neighboring apartments on the same day. Predictably, many of their belongings are delivered to the wrong place. Mr. Chow gets Mrs. Chan's bookshelf, for example, and Mrs. Chan gets Mr. Chow's books. Though both are married, their spouses are absent, and Mrs. Chow's shoes are delivered to Mrs. Chan. Throughout the film, we never see the faces of these absent spouses. The backs of their heads appear, or we hear their voices drift in from off screen. It doesn't take the two neighbors long to figure out that their spouses are cheating on them and with each other. In Infidelity's Abandonment, we see Mrs. Chan carrying a thermos to the noodle shop. She descends the stairs only to ascend them a moment later, just as Mr. Chow turns the corner and begins to walk into the shop. Later, the roles are reversed, and it is Mr. Chow who ascends, Mrs. Chan who descends. Before long, Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan, who wears a different dress in practically every scene and who ironically facilitates her boss's affairs, begin having dinner together. Clumsily, they order the dishes each other's spouse would order. She suffers through a spicy meal. He cuts his meat in a desultory way. Already neighbors, they begin to stand in for each other's spouses. Kowloon, 1956. 10 years before the Star Ferry riots, Hong Kong exploded in violence when Chinese nationalists, celebrating the revolution that overthrew the Qing dynasty, began attacking communist sympathizers. At one point, a European diplomat's wife burned to death when the car she was riding in caught fire. These earlier riots exposed the divisions that would become more explicit in 1966, but it was only after the 1967 riots that the violence became a means to expand upon the conditions that produced them. The business magnate Li Ka-shing, the pun on whose name, at least to the English ear, Ka-shing, should go without saying, began to amass his enormous fortune, which in 2007 stood in excess of $23 billion by purchasing real estate that had become massively devalued as a result of the riots. Hong Kong, 1962. Although Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan are talking almost constantly, we never see both of their faces at the same time. We see Mr. Chow's face from behind Mrs. Chan's head, or we hear their voices over the telephone. There are shots of torsos, but no heads. We hear voices, but see only a single light bulb in an abandoned hallway. They rarely seem to meet each other's gaze, and it's as if they need only do so, and perhaps have us witness it as well, to bridge the gap between them. As viewers, we're on the periphery looking in. Mr. Chow laughs with the other writers in the newspaper office, but only through the lettering on the window. We watch from the other side of the action, both as witnesses to and as interpreters of a story. Our action neighbors that of the characters. In the very same way that they are neighbors to each other's suffering, we are neighbors to theirs. We only catch glimpses of the larger political conflicts. Near the end of the movie, stock footage shows De Gaulle as he enters Phnom Penh. Like the viewers, the characters remain on the outside of the trouble exploding around them. Their love story takes place in proximity to it, and can, given the gravity of those events, come across either as the ultimate clowning around in the face of disaster, or the only thing that makes it bearable. Boulder, Colorado, 2004. By mistake, I watched the companion film to In the Mood for Love before I watched the film itself, and as a result, I have been trying to catch up ever since. This disordering may be the cause of my sensation, nonsensical in itself, that if for the rest of my life I were to watch only these two films in continuous alternation, I could be quite happy. It seems in keeping with the films that I should never be able to recapture the first movie, as Mr. Chow cannot ever recapture his past. This second film, 2046, takes its title from the number of the hotel room where, in the first film, Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan meet prior to his departure for Singapore, largely to escape their love affair, in 1963. 2046 is, in the second film, a year, a futuristic city where people go to recapture their lost memories, and the title of a story Mr. Chow has written. Ironically, the story intimates that, in looking for the past, we propel ourselves into the future in a movement that abolishes the present, while at the same time condemning one to it. Mr. Chow, whose heart is broken in the first film, becomes a heartbreaker in the second. Unable to occupy his life, he is now his own neighbor. He rents a room with the number 2047. Hong Kong, 1966. When Mr. Chow returns from Singapore, Mrs. Chan is gone. Everything has changed. That era has passed, we read on the screen, and then everything he sees is blurred and indistinct. Displacement persists in the feeling that everything repeats, but with a difference. Thailand, 1997. In the wake of the collapse of the Thai baht, a wave of economic crises spread through Asia. Currency rapidly devaluated. Poverty levels, which had been in sharp decline in the years directly preceding the crisis, rapidly escalated, and what had come to be known as the Asian economic miracle imploded. Though experts cannot agree on a single cause for the collapse, among the hypothesized culprits are China's economic expansion, a classic bank run in which the doubts of a few investors infect the market, asset prices that had been pushed to unsustainable levels by excessive amounts of credit, currency and real estate speculation, and, not coincidentally, the handover of Hong Kong's sovereignty on July 1, 1997, exactly 24 hours prior to the collapse of the baht. It was in 1998, and against this backdrop, that Wong Kar-wai began filming In the Mood for Love. Hong Kong, 1962. Rain, like the plaintive violin theme that often arises out of nowhere in the film, punctuates In the Mood for Love. Like the rain, the music obeys a logic I've never succeeded in discovering. When it begins, the film's speed slackens in time with it. That it will return, and at regular intervals, is both a promise of the melancholy that saturates the film and a cyclical marker suggesting that time is operating differently here, obeying some other prerogative. The sound of the rain is not unlike that of the shower in which, at one point, we hear a woman crying without seeing her face, and it is often during or just after one of these recurring rains that we come to see Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan discussing their neighbors and spouses. It is rain that first throws them together when they both get stuck in the noodle shop, and it is near the end of the film, just after another rain, that they begin to rehearse their departure from either one another or from their respective spouses. It's tough to tell which, because by the time we reach that point in the story, the distinction between understudy and star, who is neighboring whom, has come apart at the seams. Cambodia, 1966. In the final scene of the first film, Mr. Chow visits Cambodia. We see him at Angkor Wat, those gorgeous ruins in a country that today has the highest density of landmines in the world. A country devastated in the 1960s by a secret war with the United States that paraded for a time, as did the war in Vietnam, as a civil conflict, only to be laid waste by the monsters that took over when the warring factions left. Mr. Chow, watched by a young monk, finds a small hole in the temple wall. He whispers a secret, presumably having to do with Mrs. Chan, and covers the hole with a clump of mud. Do you know, we hear in 2046, what people did in the old days when they had secrets they didn't want to share? They'd climb a mountain, find a tree, carve a hole in it, whisper the secret into the hole or into the tree, and cover it up with mud. That way nobody else would ever learn the secret. The camera moves through the abandoned hallways and courtyards, and then, the view fixed on an open door, the film ends. The secret is lost. No one remains. Denver, February 8th through 10th, 2008. I watched both films in a continuous loop for 3 days. starting and ending within the mood for love. I cannot allow the cycle to complete itself. The films must maintain their distance from each other and from me, because at heart both are about a loss that cannot be named, cannot be grasped, lest the loss itself, the last remnant of the past, be lost as well. Though through loss we neighbor our suffering, we cannot become neighbors of ourselves, lest we turn into clowns who have only their own clowning to clown about. At the end of 3 days, there's a periodic murmur in my mind. It's either rain or violins. They simply will not go away. Thank you.
Yeah.